I really am thankful for this chance to speak to you today. Wish it was under different circumstances. I've been thinking a lot this week about the people who've made a difference in my life. People who've drawn me closer to the Lord. My dad's favorite song calls these people the lights along the shore, the lighthouses that guide our way to the Lord. I think we all want to make a difference. George Bailey is one of my favorite movie characters. I guess, like a lot of you, I watch him, his life fall apart and come back together every December. And, he wanted to do big things. And it seemed like circumstances and hard-hearted people like old Mr. Potter just kept getting in the way of every attempt he made. And sometimes, like George Bailey, I think we can feel discouraged. I know I can. Not seeing the change in the people that are in my life that I would hope to see, that I would hope to influence, much less seeing the kind of changes I'd like to see in the world around me. The movie resonates because it's hard not to occasionally ask that question, what difference do I really make? We just sang the song, we trim your feeble lamp, my brother. And sometimes it really does seem pretty feeble. So I ask, how can my light shine brighter? One of the best ways to learn to do anything is to watch a master at work, no matter what it is. In John's gospel, we see Jesus interact with everyone from strangers to his best friends. And in each interaction, he creates some connection and opens a path that allows them to at least have the opportunity to change. So how do we learn to shine? Well, we can watch the master make ordinary interactions life-changing. So I want to take a few minutes this morning and look at five stories about Jesus in the book of John and see what they can teach us about how to make a difference. The first two stories, we find that Jesus really saw people, both physically and spiritually. There's a TV show called Parenthood, and Craig T. Nelson, whenever he wants to smooth things over with his wife when he's gotten into trouble, he says, "I see you, I hear you. I see you, I hear you." It's kind of ridiculous, and my wife and I make jokes about it sometimes. But the way Jesus saw people changed them. They changed the way they responded to him and to his message. In John chapter 1, in verse 43, we see that Jesus saw Nathanael. After Jesus called Philip in John 1:43, Philip had to find his friend Nathanael and tell him that we found the one that was prophesied, Jesus of Nazareth. Nathanael's famous response was, "Can anything good come from Nazareth?" But Nathanael came, and as he approached, Jesus called out, "Behold, an Israelite in whom is no deceit." Nathanael's probably thinking, "I've never seen this guy before. I don't know who this is." And so he asks, "How do you know me?" And notice that Jesus said one sentence to Nathanael, but Nathanael gets this feeling that Jesus knows him. Jesus responds, "Before Philip called you, I saw you under the fig tree." And Nathanael says, "Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel." All of that from saying he saw him under a fig tree. Jesus answered, "Because I said to you, I saw you under a fig tree, you're amazed? Do you believe? You'll see greater things than these." He said, "You'll see heaven opened and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man." And he believed. In fact, Nathanael was probably Bartholomew of the 12 apostles. He was certainly one of the disciples after that day. So why did this interaction open him up to believe? Well, first, it was probably a miracle. Jesus probably saw him at some supernatural distance under the fig tree. But also, it was personal. Unlike most of the miracles that Nathanael would see in following Jesus, this one was about him. It was about Jesus knowing who he was. And not only that, but Jesus seeing the very best of who he was and acknowledging for it. I mean, he said, "Behold an Israelite in whom is no deceit." Surely Nathanael was not a perfect man. But Jesus looked into his heart and he saw honesty. And that's how he chose to describe him. Seeing people is serious business. It's about feeling understood. It's about feeling somebody gets me. When you hear about people doing horrible things, you know, taking their own lives, taking somebody else's life, usually it's the people that don't feel like anyone sees them. No one would get them. But someone, when someone feels understood, they open up. And our light, Jesus' light, can finally shine in. Another example of Jesus, and my faith is strengthened by reading stories like these, is when he talked to the woman at the well. I think it's not the things that Jesus did that nobody else could do that amazes me the most sometimes. It's the things that Jesus did that anybody could do, but, you know, no one else would. We'll see that with when we look at the woman, the adulterous woman. We see that in this example here, too. We find Jesus on his way from one Jewish town to another. In between, it says he had to pass through Samaria. It's kind of like having a layover in Newark, is what I was thinking when I read that. I was trying to think of what Jesus is feeling. It's not your destination. It's not even really a good stop along the way. The Jews didn't talk to Samaritans. The Jews didn't want to be in Samaria. But going from Judea to Galilee, that was the easiest way, and he kind of gets stuck there. His friends are buying meat in town, so he's waiting at a well by himself, and the noon sun is starting to beat down on him, and he's tired. He's done a lot of walking. So when a woman from town came to get water, he asked for her to get him some. And her response was basically, "Are you allowed to get me water? You know, how are you, a Jew, going to ask me, a Samaritan, for water?" And then this conversation happens. Conversation literally means a turning. You know, it's a converting, going back and forth. And we see here in this conversation, there's 13 turns. 13 times we see he said, and then she said, and he responded, and then she responded. It's a pretty long conversation for the Gospels to record in its entirety. And it's building on each other. There's listening. There's responding. They talked about her marriage history. They talked about their racial and religious differences. The Jews worship this way, and the Samaritans worship this way. And he taught her. He taught her about the living water that leaves us to thirst no more. He taught her about true worship in spirit and in truth. And what struck me about it is just how much time Jesus takes with this woman in this kind of chance encounter. And it took a lot of time to get to the most important point, which was that Jesus is the Messiah. He gets to it, but he doesn't even bring it up. She says it. She says, "We're looking for this Messiah. I know he's coming." Jesus said, "I am he." He didn't lead with the lead. He didn't start out with what he had to say. You know, I sometimes view personal evangelism, I think incorrectly, as like a presentation I need to make, like an elevator pitch, and I kind of have it in my back pocket and I'm ready to give an answer. But sometimes an answer comes from a question, comes from an interaction, comes from responding. It's a conversation. Colossians 4:6 says, "Let your conversation be always full of grace, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how to answer everyone." We're told in Ephesians 6 to have our feet shod with the preparation of the gospel of peace. So we're ready. We have the preparation on our feet. We're ready to speak the gospel. And Jesus was the master, so he could do all this in one conversation. I mean, he told her things that we could never tell her. It might take more conversations for us. It might take a lot of conversations. We need to be patient with people. Give it time. We need to know there's a point, certainly, when we need to say, this is pearls before swine. But from this, I really learned the power of conversation to change a person's life. Jesus surely could have had other things on his mind at this point. I mean, he's about to go into Galilee, which is where the bulk of his ministry is going to take place. He's got the disciples going. He has a way greater mission than any of us have. But to Jesus, whoever he was with became his mission. Next couple stories. What struck me about them was that Jesus believed in people. In John 8, verse 11, and this is truly one of those examples of Jesus doing something that we all could have done. We couldn't have forgiven her, but we could have said the things he did. We could have, really, Jesus saves a woman's life here with two long silences and one perfectly pointed question or statement. let's go ahead and read this. It's in John chapter 8, beginning verse 1. It says, early in the morning, he came again to the temple, and all the people came to him, and he sat down and taught them. The scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman who had been caught in adultery, and placing her in their midst, they said to him, teacher, this woman has been caught in the act of adultery. Now, in the law of Moses commanded us to stone such a woman. So what do you say? And they said this to test him. You know, whose side would you really expect Jesus to have been on in this conversation? Here are the Pharisees who have shown up, and they're saying they want to do the law. And here's this woman who was caught in the act of adultery and who's been brought out to be stoned and really to test Jesus. And what we really see, I think, is that Jesus doesn't take a side. He just speaks the truth and challenges all of them to sin no more and to examine themselves. It says, next, Jesus bent down and wrote with his finger on the ground. I have no idea what he wrote. I don't know. I've heard a lot of people speculate. Maybe it was the people's names. Maybe it was their sins that he was writing on the ground. Maybe it was some verse from the old law that would prick their hearts. I have no idea. Maybe it was just doodling, and maybe it was just drawing in the sand. I don't know. But he bent down and he drew. He did not respond to them. And as they continued to ask him, finally he stood up and he said to them, let him who is without sin among you be the first to throw a stone at her. And once more he bent down and wrote on the ground. But when they heard it, they went away one by one, beginning with the older ones. I just wonder why that is, you know? I think the older I get, the more I get it, because I get more and more aware of just how many sins I have and just how unworthy I am to walk around condemning others. Said, Jesus stood up and said to her, woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you? And she said, no one, Lord. And Jesus said, neither do I condemn you. Go from now on, you're good. No, he doesn't say that. Go from now on and sin no more. This woman had a record. This woman had shown that she had committed this capital offense. She had committed adultery. But Jesus believed in her enough to say, go and sin no more. He gave her another chance. And sometimes it's a lot easier to just determine who is really going to be a good prospect for us to make an impact on. And I'm not saying that there's no place for that, but these people Jesus is talking to are not really what I would call cream of the crop prospects. But he believes that people can change. He gives them space to change, and he believes it's on them. He's not going to make it happen, but he believes they can do it. Another person that he gave a choice to, that he offered an opportunity to, is found in John chapter 5. Evidently, there was a healing pool in Jerusalem, and every time an angel stirred up waters, the first person to touch it, it seems like, would be healed. This is in, I think, verses 4 and 5, or 3 and 4. As you'd expect, sick people are everywhere around this thing. I mean, imagine if that was in downtown Phoenix or something. This is right in Jerusalem. There's a healing pool that heals sick people. So people are all over, and there was a man who, he couldn't walk, and he had nobody to dip him in there, so he was pretty helpless seeing his cure in front of him, but seeing everybody jump to the front of the line every time that these waters were stirred. So Jesus saw this man, and he knew he'd been there a long time, and instead of just healing him, he asked, "Do you want to be healed?" Well, seems pretty obvious. I mean, this man had been sick for 38 years. He'd been an invalid. I think that'd be enough for a guy. But maybe Jesus understands something about our nature that we can learn from here. Jesus never forcibly changed anyone's mind. We read about him influencing people, opening up people's eyes, doing amazing things. Isn't it a little refreshing? At least to me it is. That even Jesus couldn't, or at least wouldn't, override someone's own choice, force someone to change. We have to live people making their decisions. And sometimes that's really, really sad. Sometimes the decisions that they make are really sad. Sometimes it's people that we love that we're watching make those decisions. But oftentimes, the best we can do is make their choice clear and ask them, "Do you want to live this way? Do you want me to help you find another way?" Spiritually, we can be clear. There is an answer for your guilt, for your fear, for your wandering. Do you want to be healed? Who do you think is in need in your life? Will you be direct enough to ask them? Will you be humble enough to let them choose? Jesus cared about people. And again, that was a powerful song we just sang about that. Yesterday, Dale brought up one of Ken's phrases that people don't care what you know until they know that you care. There's this story in John 11 about Lazarus. And the message comes to Lazarus, or a message comes to Jesus from Martha and says, "He whom you love is ill." And there wasn't just one that Jesus loved. But that's how Martha described Lazarus to Jesus. "He whom you love." John also calls himself the one whom Jesus loved. He never really calls himself by his own name. He always calls himself the one whom Jesus loved. So there's two people whom Jesus specifically loved. In verse 5, John makes a little side note to help us to understand the story. It says, "Now Jesus loved Lazarus and Martha and her sister." There's something powerful about seeing three people singled out with the love of Jesus. He made us. He died for us. He loves all of us. But there is a personal connection. Like all of us, there were circles of influence that Jesus had, and there were those that he knew much better than the strangers that some of the people we've talked about. To these three siblings, he was a true friend. He completely dropped his guard, and he let himself be affected by their joy, by their pain. So after this, he went to them. And Martha runs out to meet him, and they talk. But Mary doesn't come. Mary stayed home, so he sends for her. He wanted to see Mary. He wanted to be with her in this time. And then we read the beautiful verse, "Jesus wept." And everybody responds. Everybody around him sees it, and they say, "Look how he loved him." I've always thought It's a Wonderful Life would be the most depressing movie in the world if you stopped watching after an hour. It's that's what makes it good, though, really. I mean, it's you watch his entire life crumble. You watch everything fall apart. And at the end, all those doubts we find that his doubts were not justified. We see the enormous impact he had on all of these people who come in, all of these people whose lives would have been completely different. And, you know, as I was preparing this lesson, I was thinking about that and thinking about imagining the scene in heaven when all the spiritual George Baileys finally see the unseen influence that they've had for their whole life. Paul called that his joy and his crown. I brought a prop. So if you cut up open an apple and you count the seeds, usually there's about 5, you can count. You can see exactly how many seeds there are. But have you ever thought about how many apples are there in a seed? You know, one apple seed, if it becomes a tree, if just one out of those 5 seeds becomes a tree, it can create 30 bushels of apples in one season. And each of those has seeds, has trees in them, has apples in them that continue to grow long after the original apple is in the ground. And so it is with our spiritual influence. Like the Hebrew writer says, we being dead yet speak. So I think about those lights along the shore, those souls aflame with the love of Jesus. I think about Ken. He's been a strength to Adrian and I for a long time and everybody else here. I think about my grandparents and my parents and a lot of people whose faces I'm looking at right now. And I wonder if we see the power we wield for the Lord in each interaction. Do we follow the Master's example, giving the time and attention to seeing people and believing in them and caring for them? There's another song I sing to myself sometimes and inspires me. It says, so be like lights on the rim of the water, giving hope in a storm sea of life. Be a refuge amidst the slaughter of these fugitives in their flight. For you are timeless and part of a puzzle. You are winsome and young as a lad, and there is no disease or no struggle that can pull you from God. Be glad. The biggest and most important thing we can do to influence others is to tend to our own faithfulness first, and then we can be a refuge for others. Jesus has changed every life he has ever touched. The reason we're happy even today is because he gives us life, and through eternity he gives us life, because he's the risen Son of God, and he can save you if you obey him. This is a time now where we have the opportunity, everyone has the opportunity to come forward and to confess your faith in Jesus as the Son of God, to repent of your life of sin, and to be baptized for the forgiveness of your sins and become one of God's children. We invite you now to come while we stand and sing.